Thanks so much for coming today.
Thank you.
For organizing this. So today I was supposed to talk about Newton's cradle of spectra, but due to recent developments, I added more. So it's called Newton's cradle of spectra and more. And I'll tell you today about work done with Achim Kemp from University of Waterloo and Abhishek Sudhir from MIT. So the talk is going to be split into three parts. First part is going to be what I promised, Newton's cradle of spectra. Second part will be more in the tone of relativistic quantum information. So if you're interested in what they do in that community, you're going to learn about the math that they use in relativistic quantum information. So it's going to be a little bit strange, but it's going to be an introduction to the last part, which is a new tool which might be useful for people in the quantum information community. Okay, so in the first part, Newton's cradle of spectra, the question we try to answer is what happens when we add two Hamiltonians. So it's this old question that we physicists pose. Assume that you start out with a free Hamiltonian, H0, you know its eigenvalues and eigenvectors. Then there's another Hamiltonian, you can think of it as an interaction Hamiltonian, H prime. You also know its eigenvalues and its eigenvectors.
And then you add them together. And then you add them together.
And now the sum of the two Hamiltonians has its own spectrum, its own eigenvectors, but it's not trivial to find them. It's a hard problem,
as we all know.
And because it's a hard problem, typically we approach it perturbatively. There are some non-perturbative results on what to do when we add two Hamiltonians. We know about Wigner von Neumann result on level repulsion. We know about Wells inequalities. But we'd all agree that there are too few non-perturbative results. And so today I'll tell you about a new non-perturbative result on an addition of Hamiltonians, which we call Newton's cradle spectra. So in order to answer this question, we are going to simplify it. At first, we're going to ask what happens when we add just a rank one projector to a free Hamiltonian. If we know the answer to that question, then we can build the full interaction Hamiltonian by just adding one by one projector. Okay, so the setup of the problem is that we know the initial eigenvalues and the eigenvectors of S0. The eigenvalues are Si, and the eigenvectors get Si. And then we ask what happens to the eigenvalues. Very quickly, we can say something about the behavior of the sum of the eigenvalues of S of mu. We know that when we take the derivative of the sum, it's positive, which means that the sum is always increasing as we increase the coupling constant. But then what can we tell about each individual eigenvalue? And today I'll show you that as we increase the coupling constant, also all the eigenvalues increase at the same time. So it's not just the sum, it's also each individual eigenvalue. And this is the plot of that. For example, if you have three eigenvalues, you can see in this plot that all of the eigenvalues increase as we increase the coupling constant. And this is the generic behavior. Yes.
Sorry, Robert, I missed the back in the previous slide. I missed why you can say that the derivative of the sum is one.
Oh, it's just you take the derivative of the trace.
So you basically just
take. The trace is said to be.
So the eigenvalues of this are Si, so it's sum of Si, they don't depend on mu. So you just the trace of the.
Okay.
Yeah, it's simple. Okay, so yeah, this is the generic behavior of eigenvalues when you add the rank one projector. So generically, the overlap between the vector v and an original eigenvector si is non-zero. And generically, this is the behavior it causes. Basically, the eigenvalues always increase and they do not cross. That's very important. If one of these overlaps was zero, imagine that the overlap vector ket S2 was zero, then this S2 energy level would be constant. and S1 would have crossed it. So that's the case where this overlap is equal to zero. But generically, we have that all the overlaps are non-zero, and we get this behavior. And here you'll see in an animation what it looks like. You'll see why we named it Newton's Gradle Spectra. Basically, as you change the coupling constant mu from minus infinity to some finite value, the lowest eigenvalue shoots up from minus infinity, and then it kind of kicks all the other eigenvalues. And then as you keep increasing mu, the largest eigenvalue picks up the momentum and shoots off to plus infinity.
So that's what it looks like, and that's why we named it Newton's Gradle.
A little bit about the properties of this. The spectra, when you take the union over all the coupling constants mu, and when you take all the eigenvalues in the spectra, they cover the real line and exactly once. And that's an interesting property because, for example, let's say this is an interesting problem you can solve using that property. Let's say you start up with a free Hamiltonian, which has its spectrum, but you don't like that spectrum, you want to change it. And in particular, you want the real number S to be in your new spectrum. Let's say this is something that you want to do. Well, you know, for each real number S, there is a mu which produces S as an eigenvalue of the operator S of mu. And the way to calculate mu which produces that eigenvalue S is from this formula. This formula gives you direct relationship between the coupling constant and an eigenvalue in the spectrum. So that's a new formula. And notice that you can plug in any coupling constant here. It can be any number, so it's non-perturbative. And this is what it looks like in a plot. You can see how the spectrum develops as you change the coupling constant mu. Notice when mu goes to plus infinity or minus infinity, there are these asymptotes that the spectrum approaches. These asymptotes are connected to the Cauchy interlacing theorem. Yes.
So all this whole, is it still covered in your film?
Is it covered when you take mu equals infinity? Yes, in that sense, it's covered. Yes.
And covered once, just once.
Yes.
Because if you approach from different direction, it's going to cover twice.
If you take plus infinity and minus infinity, you get the same number, and then it's probably exactly one.
You call it one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So this, who knows about Cauchy's interlacing theorem? I usually ask this question. Okay. Some people know. So it's very simple to state. The theorem tells you that if you start out with an n by n self-adjoint matrix, such as this one, it has its eigenvalues, S1 to S4. Then if you cross out a row and a column, and that's how you produce a new matrix M prime, the new matrix has its eigenvalues as primed. The theorem tells you that the new eigenvalues interlace the old eigenvalues. So that's what the theorem tells you. And in the plot that I just showed, you can see this exactly. You can see what happens. Basically, when you take the coupling constant mu to go to plus infinity, the subspace of the Hilbert space related to the projector V just decouples, and then the spectrum changes to these S star values. And you can calculate exactly what those values are by just saying mu is equal to infinity. And then you get the expression which will calculate which you need to solve to calculate the eigenvalues that you get from crossing out a row and a column. Okay, so that was about eigenvalues. I also promised to say what happens to the eigenvectors. Well, assume that S is an eigenvector corresponding to eigenvalue S. So the operator, when we add the projector, has the eigenvector S and an eigenvalue S. The new eigenvector, cat S, can be expressed in the original eigenbasis, which were these vectors, Sn, and we can calculate exactly how the eigenvector changes. Notice that this expression maybe looks a little bit complicated, but it's actually very simple. You can just say that the overlap between the old eigenvector and the new eigenvector is just proportional to Vn. Vn is the overlap between V and an old and the old eigenvector. And you have to divide it by new eigenvalue minus the old eigenvalue. So it's a very simple expression. Okay. Now, I've been talking about Newton's cradle of self-adjoint operators, but there's also the unitary version of Newton's cradle. It just works with unitary operators. Instead, you start out with a unitary operator whose eigenvalues and eigenvectors you know. And then in order to create the Newton's cradle kind of behavior, you don't add a projector. Instead, you act multiplicatively with the projector deformation. So this is the identity matrix, and this is some projector WW. And then we have a parameter alpha, which can go between 0 and 2 pi. And as you change this parameter alpha, you produce the Newton's cradle kind of behavior. This is what it looks like. No, it doesn't resemble Newton's cradle so much anymore because the eigenvalues, of course, have to live on a unit circle. But the behavior is similar because all the eigenvalues are moving in the same direction, and generically they don't cross each other. And these two Newton's cradles are actually related by a straightforward Cayley transform. So this is what it looks like in operators. It maybe looks complicated, but it's actually very simple. For eigenvalues, this is just a Möbius transform, which relates the numbers on the real line to numbers on a unit circle in the complex plane. And we have exact expressions which relate the coupling constant mu that I talked about in the beginning and this parameter alpha of the unitary Newton's cradle. And that's what it looks like in a plot. Okay, and now a nice message. When we started learning quantum mechanics, we quickly learned that addition of Hamiltonians doesn't nicely translate to multiplication of unitaries. And that's because of the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula. So that's unfortunate. But here we found something interesting, which is when we related the self-adjoint operator to a unitary operator via the Cayley transform instead, then the addition of a projector nicely translated to the multiplication on the unitary side. So if you want that to happen, use Cayley transform instead of the exponential map. Okay, and just one, yes.
Get back to that slide. The last slide. What did you mean? I'm not sure what you meant by that. So, if I still take the two unitaries you're considering and exponentiate them, yeah. I still will have the non-commuting part, just as you.
Sure.
So, what is it that is now not?
It's just the addition translates nicely to multiplication, but you have to take the Cayley transform of the self-adjoint operator and not the exponential. You know, there are different ways you can produce a unitary operator from a self-adjoint operator. One way is to use the exponential map, like this, and another way is to use the Cayley transform, and this one is nicer. That's the message.
Okay. Say h1 goes to u1, h2 goes to u2, then like what if h1 is back h2? And what if h1 back h2 goes to?
So as I just said, when you start with some free Hamiltonian and you add a projector to it, okay, that translates nicely when you take the Cayley transform to starting out with some free unitary operator and acting on it with a U1 deformation, right? Multiplicatively. So addition here translated nicely to multiplication here. Whereas if I did it in the exponential map, then I would produce the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula. That's the idea. Okay, so finally, in this part of the talk, let's talk about level repulsion. Level repulsion is this, you know, it's been known for a very long time that when you start out with some Hamiltonian A, and then you add to it a Hamiltonian B, multiplied by a coupling constant C, and then you vary the coupling constant C, such as here, and then you look at what the energy levels do, you notice that the energy levels sometimes get closer to each other, but then they repel each other. They tend to not cross, basically. That's what was noticed, is that the energy levels don't like to cross, generically speaking. So using the Newton's cradle, you can understand why this generically happens. And the strategy to understand that is to decompose the interaction Hamiltonian B into a sum of projectors, and then add the projectors one by one. And then, as we learned in the beginning of this presentation, whenever the overlap between a projector and an eigenvector is non-zero, then the eigenvalues cannot cross as we vary the coupling constant. And because generically these overlaps are non-zero, you know, zero is much rarer than any other number when you're trying to hit it, that's why generically there's no level crossing. So to summarize this part of the talk, we learned that when we add a rank one projector to self-adjoint operator, that as we vary the coupling constant, the eigenvalues generically move like Newton's cradle, and we saw how the eigenvectors evolve. Because we can decompose any interaction Hamiltonian into a sum over projectors, this is a new strategy for understanding addition of Hamiltonians, a new strategy for understanding non-perturbative physics. So, and we also saw that this gave us an understanding of Cauchy interlacing theorem and level repulsion. I'm not going to talk about applications today, but maybe you can ask me in the questions part. I would like to move on to this relativistic quantum information part of the talk, which will be a nice introduction to the last part of the talk. And this was worked on by Vivishek, Sudhir, and Ahim. So we were thinking about how acceleration doesn't fit naturally into quantum physics. Of course, you know, we have some examples where we've solved problems related to acceleration and quantum physics, for example, the Andrew effect, but we definitely want to know more. And the reason is, at least for us, is that acceleration is related to gravity via the equivalence principle. So the more we understand about the acceleration, the more we understand about gravity in quantum physics. So here today, I'll tell you about two new acceleration-induced phenomena, which will lead to increased measurability of the Unruh effect, and it will give us insights into acceleration and gravity. Because this audience doesn't necessarily know the details of light-matter interactions, I will just schematically tell you about a different kinds of transitions that these interactions cause. You can have resonant transitions and non-resonant transitions. The resonant ones are the usual ones, absorption and emission. They are strong, and because they are strong, that's why they are the usual ones. They are everywhere around us. And we know that they can be stimulated. That means that the probability of these transitions can be increased by the presence of photons in the field. So you use a laser, you basically, in your experiment, you use a laser in order to increase the probability. On the other hand, there are the non-resonant transitions. They are unusual. Unruh effect and Hawking effect are caused by these transitions. They are weak, which is why they are unusual. And they need to be activated by acceleration or gravity in order to even be seen. Okay, and so here today, I'll tell you about something new on the resonant side. I'll show you how the resonant transitions can be modulated with acceleration and gravity, or gravity. And this will lead to a new phenomenon of acceleration-induced transparency. On the other hand, I'll also show that the non-resonant transitions can be stimulated as well, and that makes non-resonant effects, think Unruh effect, Hawking effect, it makes them much more measurable. So the way this is going to work is that we will first stimulate the Unruh effect by the presence of photons in the quantum field. This will increase the probability of seeing the Unruh effect greatly. Then a problem will arise, which is that stimulating the Unruh effect also stimulates resonant transitions. But we came up with a solution called acceleration-induced transparency. This is a phenomenon which suppresses the resonant transitions to zero. So what we are left with in the end is just a strong Unruh effect that's potentially measurable in the lab. So this is what I promised, the math of RQI community. So this is a typical toy model of light matter interactions. On one hand, you have an Unruh with detector. It's a two-level quantum system with an energy gap omega. And on the other hand, you have a scalar quantum field with its standard free Hamiltonian. They're interacting with this interaction Hamiltonian, coupling constant G, flipping operator on the Unruh de Witt detector, and the field interacts with the detector along the trajectory of the detector. And if you look at this interaction Hamiltonian in details, you see that it splits up into two parts, and these are the resonant transition interaction terms that I was talking about, and non-resonant interaction terms I was talking about. The resonant ones basically cause either the detector to get excited while the field gets de-excited, or the other way around. And the non-resonant transitions, which are responsible for the Unruh effect, either excite both the detector and the field at the same time, or de-excite them both at the same time.
Can you say a little more about why you call these resonant versus non-resonant?
Yeah, sure. Basically, these guys can be, resonant transitions. You can see them even if the detector is inertial motion, as long as you hit the right frequency of the gap. Whereas the non-resonant transitions, if the detector is in inertial motion, you won't even see them. You need to activate them by gravity or acceleration. You can think of them as these ones are energy conserving and these ones are not, something like that. Because these ones, you know, kind of pick up a photon while exciting the detector, or the other way around, whereas these ones are a bit weird because they either excite both of them at the same time or de-excite both of them at the same time. So you need to kind of give them something to activate them. Okay. So the typical calculation, the standard Unruh effect, is to calculate the amplitude for the transition where the field and the detector start out in their ground and vacuum state, and then the detector ends up excited. That's what we want to calculate. And we do that in first order perturbation theory because the coupling constant G is small. And so you calculate this amplitude, it's not too complicated, and you find that its structure is very simple. You just have this coupling constant G, a normalization, and most importantly, you have this time integral, I plus, which looks like this. You can think of it as a Fourier transform of a phase function, which arises due to the trajectory, x mu. That's the way to think about it. Okay, now to the stimulated Unruh effect. This was the idea, you know, we had in order to increase the probability of seeing the Unruh effect. The setup is the same, except when you except the field now starts out in an excited state. So the detector still starts out in a ground state, but the field is initially in an excited state. And you calculate the transition, and you find that there is the square root of n enhancement of the Unruh effect. At the same time, there's now the resonant contribution also appeared, and it also comes with the square root of n, so we are going to have to deal with it. Just as a comparison, as I said, in the standard Lanner effect, we start out with both the field and the detector in their ground and vacuum state, whereas in the stimulated effect, the field starts out in an excited state, which we use to enhance the probabilities. And when you look at what that does to probabilities, we find that the Lanner effect is enhanced by number n plus 1, but at the same time, we have a resonant contribution, which we don't want. We just want to see unruh contribution to the effect. And you can capture this by a simple statement that probability of excitations was enhanced by n, where n is the number of photons in the field.
Okay.
So as I said, the resonant contribution is now has now appeared, and we don't want to see the resonant contribution. We want to get rid of it. So how do we do that? Basically, the only freedom that we have here is in these time integrals I plus and I minus that appear in the expression for the probability. One of them, I plus, contributes to the unruh transition. I minus contributes to the resonant transition. So we want to get rid of I minus. Typically, as I said before, I minus, it's easy to get rid of I plus, because every time you're in inertial motion, I plus is just zero, and I minus, you can achieve it to be non-zero, so that's typical. But for this work, we wanted to switch this, and we wanted to achieve that I minus is zero, while I plus is non-zero, so the other way around. But the way to achieve that is non-trivial, because you cannot just plug in inertial motion anymore. You have to engineer the trajectory to achieve that. So the question was, can we tune our trajectories x mu so that for a detector gap omega, the I plus integral is equal to zero, which would then suppress resonant transitions? And we found that the answer is yes. We showed that for the simple kind of trajectory where you change the velocity of your inertial motion twice, it works if you choose the suitable parameters. And also for a smoother type of trajectory, we also prove that this is possible. So once we found that there are trajectories which cause I minus to be zero, well, that's great, because now if we choose that trajectory, we know the detector with gap omega will not get this excited due to resonant terms. So because this integral is zero, that means that the detector will not get excited due to resonant terms. At the same time, I plus is non-zero, which means that in an experiment, if we see that the detector got excited, well, it must be due to non-resonant terms or due to the unruh effect interaction terms. And this is what it looks like in a plot. You can see the absorption curve for resonant transitions. There are two resonance peaks, and in between them, there's a point where the absorption goes exactly to zero. And if we choose the trajectory which causes this absorption curve, and the detector gap is omega here, then we won't see any resonant transitions. At the same time, the unruh time integral is larger than zero, which means we will see some unruh contribution. Okay, so to sum it up, we showed that non-resonant transitions in light-matter interactions can be stimulated. This makes the transitions n times stronger. So that's this n that appears in probabilities. Unfortunately, we also saw that stimulating the unruh terms stimulates the resonant terms, but we solved that problem by engineering the trajectory carefully, which that's called the acceleration-induced transparency, and it suppresses the resonant terms. And what we are left with is a strong unruh effect and a new method to measure the unruh effect in lab. Two new effects, stimulated unruh effect and acceleration-induced transparency. combining them leads to this nice schematic formula that stimulated is n times standard Unruh effect, where n can be a very big number. That's the whole point of this, is to increase the probability of the Unruh effect greatly. And so when you take this modest, you know, approximation of how many photons you can pump into your experiment, you get a number of 10 to the 16. So it looks like it's doable. And actually, our colleague on the paper, Vivek Sudhir, is currently working on building this experiment. And finally, I talked about gravity in the beginning. I'll just say that these acceleration-induced effects suggest that we could also look for gravity-induced effects, such as gravity-induced translucency or transparency. And since we showed that we can stimulate the Unruh effect, why not? We could also stimulate the Hawking effect by the presence of photons in the field, for example, by the presence of photons in an accretion disk around the black hole. And this is the paper that this work is based off. Now, finally, the last part, which will be interesting to the quantum information community. So it's called parametrically induced decoupling, and it's something new and unpublished. So the way I got this idea is I understood that acceleration-induced transparency, the phenomena I just showed you, the acceleration-induced transparency, what it did for us is turn off some kind of transitions, namely the resonant transitions in the context of light-matter interactions. And the way we achieved that was by controlling the trajectory of the Unruh limit detector. So the choice of trajectory gave us some parametric control over the interaction Hamiltonian. Okay, and that was in the context of light-matter interactions. But once you realize that the trajectory just gave you a way to control the interaction Hamiltonian, then you see a path into how to generalize this to general interaction scenarios. Namely, the idea is to use parametric control that you have over the interaction Hamiltonian to turn off some transitions. And this might be, this might be interesting to all kinds of applications in quantum control, maybe in adiabatic quantum computing, where you want to turn off the transition between the ground and the excited state. Who knows? And the setup I'm going to describe is very simple, general setup. The total Hamiltonian consists of a free Hamiltonian H0, and you add to it an interaction Hamiltonian, which you have some parametric control over that interaction Hamiltonian. Today, I will use just the simplest case of a Hamiltonian, which is a rank one projector. That's not necessary, that's just the simplest thing that I can use to show the phenomenon. So it's not necessary, it's just simple. I will work in the interaction picture. Since I know everything about my free Hamiltonian, I know its eigenvalues and eigenvectors, and I know that my interaction Hamiltonian is just a rank one projector, I can quickly write down its time evolution in the interaction picture. No need to worry about details. And I will work in the first order perturbation theory. That just means that I'm using a weak coupling assumption, just like we had in the Unruh effect. Okay. So I told you that I will use this to turn off some transitions. So for example, let's look at the transition between a ground state and an excited state caused by this time evolution, UI. If you do the math, it's not complicated, you find an expression like this. So the probability of exciting the system from its ground state to some excited state is this. This is the coupling constant. Maybe we have some control over the coupling constant. These are components of the interaction Hamiltonian. And then we have e to the I omega t, where omega is the gap between the ground and the excited state. And if we want to turn off the transition between the ground and the excited state, what we want to achieve is that this probability is equal to zero. That's the goal. So basically, the problem here is to find a function of time, f of t, such that this integral is equal to zero. And the idea is that the function f of t is induced by either the time change of the coupling constant or the interaction of Hamiltonian.
And now I'll show you that you can indeed do this.
Of course, you can make some simple choice of f of t, like a plane wave and so on, but that's not that interesting. We are looking for a more general class of solution. And luckily, we already found a function f of t from acceleration due transparency, which solves the problem for us. Basically, if you take f of t to be equal to this function, where x mu is a trajectory which causes acceleration due transparency, then we know that this time integral will be zero. We already proved that in the second part of this talk. So if you choose f of t to be this, then the probability of excitation will be zero. So we will not excite the system from its ground to the excited state using this interaction Hamiltonian. And just to show you examples of how this works, first example is where the coupling constant is just a constant. We don't vary it, but we vary the trajectory in time. And the way we do that is we vary the phases that multiply the components. We vary them in time. And we just plug that into the formula for the probability of excitation, find an expression like this. And we see that if we make the right choice of the time dependencies here, we can indeed have the probability to be zero, or in other words, we can indeed turn off the transition. And the second example is where we vary the coupling constant in time. So that's a function of time now. Because the coupling constant is a real number or a real function in time, we need to use two projectors in order to turn off transitions. Why? Because of course, in this time integral, we have complex numbers, so we need 2 degrees of freedom to turn off the integral. So instead of adding just one projector, we have to add 2 projectors. And when we write out the formula for the probability, we get an expression like this. And we find if we again make the right choices for the time variation of the coupling constant, we can turn off the transitions as well. So this is just new preliminary calculations. It's a new result which might be useful in different areas in quantum information. So that's all. That's all I wanted to tell you today. The talk consisted of 3 parts. In the first part was what I promised in the abstract, Newton's cradle spectra. Then the second talk was basically an introduction for parametrically induced decoupling, which is a generalization of acceleration-induced transparency. These two tools for quantum interactions gave us new insights into non-perturbative interactions, namely that was part of Newton's cradle spectra. And we learned that there is a new way to turn off some transitions when we have parametric control over the interaction Hamiltonian. And that's it.
Okay, great talk. Any questions?
So in the part on the acceleration-induced transparency and the under effect, the calculation you did it for Fox states, right?
Yes.
But then a laser pointer is outputting a coherent state. Right.
Yeah.
Is it still valid in that case?
Yes. So usually I have a slide also about that, but because I don't have a lot of time, it's true for any extended state as long as the expected value of the number operator
is n, same thing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's always n.
Any other questions?
Yes.
So you have to get this trajectory to follow the right path, and then you have this induced transparency.
Yes.
So is this some sort of sense of idealization? Because you know, classically you can imagine making a trajectory follow.
Yeah.
Such path, but if it's a quantum system, you can't do that fully. Is that an issue here?
Yes, it's definitely an idealization, and you know, we are just assuming that we can control the trajectory to be a classical trajectory. And in fact, a part of the measurement protocol is to measure the back reaction that the Unruh-de-Witt detector has when it absorbs a photon. And in the paper with Achim, Bibishek, and Nadim, they assume that the trajectory is not just classical, but that, you know, it can be spread out in a quantum way. And then they calculated how the back reaction works in that case. So, but typically, yeah, in the Unruh effect, you do assume that the trajectory is classical, and depending on, you know, what do you measure in the lab, it's a good enough approximation.
Okay, any question from Zoom? Okay, that seems clear again.